Okay, good morning, all. So we'll start now, I think. So before we begin, just a few introductory remarks. So, well, first of all, sorry, before we really begin, thank you to our sponsors, to Sari and Stan Fish, to Reza and Mike Golubin, to Stacey and to Howard Nathanson for sponsoring the breakfast this morning. We are always open to more sponsors, and God willing, when we do the next year in a month, we will again be looking for sponsors. So if today's not the right day, then God willing, in a month it will be. But really, also just a thank you to Stan for putting everything together, putting the order in, really just kind of taking it, the order, taking it. Once I just asked him to do it, he just did it right away. So really, thank you so much for everything you put into it. Okay, so a few more introductory remarks about who Rav Kook actually was. So Rav Kook is probably arguably one of the most influential rabbis of the 20th century. There is a picture that I have here that usually is hanging in my house. He is on my wall of four other rabbis who I keep up there because I think that they are five of the most influential rabbis of the 20th century. If you want to know who the other people are, then you can feel free to come take a look, God willing, at our new house when everything is back on the wall again. But so he clearly was one of the most influential rabbis of the 20th century. In particular, Rav Kook is known for being the founder of religious Zionism. Everyone knows that this is who he was. That's kind of what he embodied. But what we'll see is that he's a lot more than that. There is so much more to his character and to his personality that he just was not only a religious Zionist. What it seems, though, is that most of the things that kind of made up his personality ended up coming out of the fact that he was a religious Zionist. So, for example, we'll see in a little while how when he started his yeshiva, he founded a new yeshiva with a purpose of learning Torah that will conclude with a halacha the maisa, with a practical application. And the reason why is because if you are going to live in the land of Israel, if you're going to live as a nation that is in control of itself, then you also have to be able to live in the country and run the country by yourself. So that means that there will be situations where you will have to be mechallel Shabbos and things like that, which means that you need to apply the Torah in a new way. No longer can we just learn lamdasha sugyas. We have to learn practical halacha to make conclusions so that we can run a country properly. So many of his beliefs in his life seem to have all come out of the fact that he was a religious Zionist, but of course, there really was so much more to him than that. Another interesting point just to kind of point out is that he is credited surely as being the founder of religious Zionism, but he clearly was not the first person, the first Orthodox rabbi to delve into religious Zionism. Probably most notably before him was Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, a rabbi who lived between the years of 1795 and 1874. He published a famous book called Drishat Zion, which basically went through many of the applications of Zionism in the land of Israel, and he published this in 1862, which was 3 years before Rav Kook was born. So clearly there were people that came before him, but Rav Kook was for sure probably the most influential and the most well-known for various reasons, as we will see. Two stories to introduce who he was as a person, and I think both of them kind of give a different perspective of who he was, and the truth is that the way to really understand who he was is to fuse both of these stories together. So the first story is that both of them happened over the course of the year of 1913, when Rav Kook and a bunch of other rabbis took a tour of a bunch of yeshuvim. And they were mostly secular, and the whole idea was this was called the Tshuva campaign by many. They were trying to convince a lot of these secular Zionists who are working on these yeshuvas to become religious again. And so a few two moments in particular that kind of stand out, and I think that are important to recognize who Rav Kook actually was. So the first story is that he was in a his student or friend Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap were together sleeping in the same room. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap wakes up and he sees his Rebbe, Rav Kook, just kind of pacing back and forth, and he's like very flustered. And it's in the middle of the night, so he wakes up and he taps his Rebbe on the shoulder. He says, "Rebbe, what's going on? Are you okay?" And Rav Kook turns to him and says, "Yeah, I just can't sleep because I am so enthralled by the idea of how much I love God." That was one moment that particularly happened with Rav Kook that was striking. And another interesting story that we can tell about Rav Kook can also be found in our packets. The way, way last page in source number 10. We'll just read it inside because it is such the text is pretty impressive. So what you need to know as a background for this story is that in one of the yeshuvas that he visited was the Puriyah Yeshuv. And this yeshuv was actually, interestingly, made up of about 40 people from St. Louis, Missouri, who decided that they were going to the land of Israel to work the land a little bit. The person who is telling the story, who wrote this story, is a man by the name of Abraham Rosenblatt. He was a man who worked in this yeshiva, and he writes as follows in source number 10. We're going to skip around a little bit. You'll notice that in these packets there is a lot of pages, and we're going to skip around kind of here and there, but I will do my best to kind of guide everyone where I'm skipping to. So the first line of source number 10, we are fortunate to possess Avraham Rosenblatt's testimony of that evening in a letter written nearly 60 years after the event, after Rav Kook had visited his yeshiva. Skip to the next paragraph. I recall a beautiful episode, says Avraham Rosenblatt, that took place 57 years ago when Rav Kook toured the Moshavot in the Galilee. I was working in the Poriah farm near the town of Tiberias. At the time, we were just a handful of 60 workers. In the end of Tishrei 5674, we heard...
What page?
Oh, sorry. It's the final page of the booklet.
Next to last page. Last page.
We heard that Rav Kook, together with three other rabbis, Rabbis Zonenfeld, Yadler, and Horowitz, were touring the isolated Moshavot in the Galilee in order to influence them to greater religious observance and purity. Skip to the middle of the next paragraph. We sat in the dining hall singing and dancing as was our custom back then. Skip one more time. To the next paragraph. We had already finished eating. We were dancing and singing, God will rebuild the Galilee, when Rav Kook joined in and danced with the men. Suddenly, Rav Kook turned to me and my friend Pinchas Schneerson. We were both on guard duty that night. We were wearing Arab cloaks and keffiyeh headdresses with rifles slung on our shoulders. Rav Kook asked us to accompany him to the manager's office. I was shorter than the rabbi, but Schneerson was tall. So Rav Kook asked Schneerson if he could borrow his uniform. The three of us returned to the dancing with the Rav wearing a keffiyeh on his head and a rifle over his shoulder. Everyone stared at Rav Kook's change of dress. The truth is, the clothes suited him. The Rav began to sing a song from the liturgy of Itahir Libeinu, but to purify our hearts so it may truly sense you. Turn to the back page. Then the rabbi stopped and spoke to us. Dear brothers, holy brothers, builders of the land, just as I am not embarrassed to wear your garments, so too I request, do not be embarrassed by the Torah of Israel. In the merit of observing the Torah's mitzvos, you will live many years in the land of Israel in sanctity and purity in the study of the Holy Torah. Is it so hard to be a Jew? In your homes in the diaspora, you were certainly educated in the spirit of Judaism. Your homes were conducted in purity and religious observance. Please, he begged them. Rav Kook concluded his address with the following request. I will not remove the uniform of your guard unless you promise me, all of you, with one heart and a willing soul, that you will fulfill my request. I ask that you should be guards, that you guard over your pintle yid, your inner Jewish spark. And everyone cried out, we promise. So this very much encapsulates who Rav Kook was. He was a man who, on the one hand, had this raging love of God that he could not seem to overcome. Which he just was always enthralled in this immense love of God. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he was this person who was also, and obviously they are connected, loved every single Jew. And he always fought as much as he can to protect the recognition of the fact that every single Jew was valuable and important, even if they were, obviously, if they were religious, and of course, even if they were secular as well. And what's so incredible about this story is that everyone knew it so well and felt it so much that when he asked an entire yeshuv of non-religious people to become frum, they all said, we promise we will become frum. Now, obviously, the skeptics in the audience will then say, well, what happens the day after when he left? Okay, maybe they weren't frum anymore. But nonetheless, what was so powerful about Rav Kook is that people would just, you know, they wouldn't just like laugh at him and say, oh, come on, Rabbi, you're ridiculous. They were so amazed and inspired by him that they said, okay, of course we'll become frum. So that is really who Rav Kook is in a nutshell, both of these stories. So a few more just brief notes before we begin. So the way we're going to study Rav Kook and truly understand who he was is probably in a way that he himself would really appreciate, is by going through various events and Torah, either lectures or writings that he has. Now, Rav Kook was well known to be an avid writer. He always was writing. Somewhat well known that he used to like using a pencil over a pen, because a pen had to be dipped in an inkwell and he would have to stop, take a break from his writing, whereas a pencil he was able to keep writing. So he used the pencil in an ideal way. It's also noted about him that when he used to write, sometimes he would just be so ingrained in his thought and that he would be writing on the page and he would just go beneath the page and write onto the table, that he was actually, because he was just so enthralled in the thought that he actually had. What is probably most well known about Rav Kook, though, is the fact that in his writings, they are so cryptic and so hard to understand because of the fact they are written on such a high level, because when he wrote famously, he would just easily quote various sources from Tanakh, from the Medrash, from the Gemara, as he was writing. And so when you read his words, sometimes it's almost impossible to understand because there are so many connotations and interpretations that you could have from the words that he writes. So that is probably what makes him so difficult to study and so difficult to truly understand, because if you want to understand him through his writings really are difficult. So we will nonetheless attempt to truly understand who he was through many of his teachings and his writings. But what we do have to make note of is the fact that Rav Kook himself did not publish that much. Rav Kook gave many famous speeches, and he wrote a lot, but he only published very little, and a lot was actually published posthumously. There's a lot of disputes among the things that were published in his name, but there are lots and lots of books that are published with in Rav Kook's name, so we'll have to maybe deal with that a little bit as well. So, without further ado, let's begin. So, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook was born on the 16th of Elul, in the month of September of 1865. The stuff that I'm telling you now is not in your booklet. This is just me speaking. But I'll let you know once I go to the booklet. And he passed away in the year 1935 on the 3rd of Elul. He is known as Harav, which means in English, the Rav. So if you're used to calling Rabbi Soloveitchik the Rav, and you go to Israel and you hear people saying Harav, it could get a little bit confusing because it sounds like they're saying the same thing. But no, Harav is always Rav Kook in Israel. He had an interesting sort of a mixed background. His father was a man by the name of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman HaKohen Kook, who studied in the yeshiva of Volozhin, so he had a very Lithuanian background. His mother, on the other hand, came from a more Hasidish Chabadnik kind of background. Her name was Zlata Pearl. So some people like to say that it could be that his openness and love for all Jews may have started from the very beginning. The fact that he had his parents were some sort of like a mixed marriage, a Litvak and a Chassid. So some people say that could be a kind of a, how his openness really all began. So as he grew up, by the age of 18, he entered into the Volozhin Yeshiva, where he studied there for not too long, only for about a year and a half. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, very famously was quoted. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he said very famously that if the Volozhin Yeshiva had been founded just to educate Rav Kook himself, and that's it, then it would have been worth founding. That's how respected and well appreciated and seen Rav Kook was in the Yeshiva, even though he was only there for a short amount of time. After he left yeshiva, a lot of things happened very quickly in the first few years of post-yeshiva. So in 1886, he married a girl by the name of Batsheva. She was the daughter of a person named the Aderet, who was the rabbi of Panovich. Aderet stands for Rabbi Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Toomim. He was a very big rabbi of the time. After he was married in 1887, at the age of 23, he became the rabbi of a town in Lithuania called Zamol. Following that, the year after, his wife tragically died, and he ended up marrying his wife's cousin, the daughter of the Aderet's twin brother, whose name was Reza Rivka. They had a son together named Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Tzvi Yehuda Kook very famously took over the legacy of his father. He became Rosh Yeshiva after his father at Yeshivat Merkaz Harav. He was very well known and very well liked and seen as kind of one of the main people continuing on the legacy of Rav Kook. After his son was born in 1891, in 1895, Rav Kook became the rabbi of a town in Latvia known as Boisk. Following that, a number of years later, in 1904, that's kind of where the story as we know it in many ways begins, because that's when he becomes, in 1904, at the age of 39, he becomes the chief rabbi of Yafo. Now, Yafo, of course, is modern-day Tel Aviv, as far as I understand. What was probably most interesting about his experience and about the person that he was as the chief rabbi of Yafo was that he had two very conflicting parties that he had to deal with. He had the old yeshuv, who were the frum people, right? The people who had been there for a long time, who were very traditional, who had been keeping all the mitzvahs and doing all the like, and the new yeshuv, which were people who had moved to Israel to build the land up a little bit, and they were totally secular. So he had to figure out a way to kind of combine these two parties, or to be the rabbi of these two parties. And really, this is kind of... Sorry?
How did it get from Europe to...
Okay, so it's a good question. So it seems like basically he was kind of recruited, much to the dismay of a lot of rabbis in Europe. A lot of rabbis said once he was going to Israel, they said, you can't leave, we need you here, you're such an amazing person, we need you here. And so it really was to the dismay of a lot of people back in Europe, but he was recruited and he saw it as an opportunity to be a rabbi in the land of Israel.
So what year did he go to Israel?
He went to Yafo, became the chief rabbi there in 1904, so at the age of 39. So, this was really where he became very, very well known, and much of the works and the speeches that we know of happened after this point. This is where he had to kind of figure out what it meant to be a rabbi in Israel, to be a rabbi if you were going to have a nation that will all come back to its land. Well, then you have to figure out how everyone's going to work together, the secular people and the religious people. So, most notably, of course, it happened somewhat conveniently in 1904, that Theodor Herzl passed away at that point. Now, what's so fascinating about Theodor Herzl, take a look at source number one on page number one in your booklets. So this is a opening paragraph followed by a transcript of the hesped, of the eulogy that Rav Kook gave at Herzl's funeral. But take a look at the beginning in source number one, the first paragraph. On the 20th of Tammuz 5664, July 3rd, 1904, Dr. Theodor Herzl, founder of the Zionist movement, died at the tragically young age of 44. Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, the newly installed rabbi of the port city of Jaffa, was asked to participate in a memorial service to honor the departed leader. Rav Kook was placed in a difficult situation, for which there was no totally satisfactory solution. On the one hand, the halacha is quite specific when it comes to those who have deviated from the norms of Torah, that says in the Shulchan Aruch, whoever secedes from the way of the community, namely persons who throw off the yoke of commandments from upon their neck, and do not participate with the Jewish people in their observances, and honoring the festivals and sitting in the synagogue and study house, but rather are free to themselves as the other nations, and so too the apostates and informers, for none of these persons does one mourn. So if you can't mourn for someone who is totally secular and has given up all mitzvos, then how in the world does the chief rabbi of Yaakov then go ahead and give a hesped, give a eulogy at his memorial service at his funeral? So obviously nowadays this is a much larger discussion that we will not go into right this second. This is a very complicated piece of the Shulchan Aruch. In general, we are, I guess you can use the words, more lenient on this nowadays. But for, of course, the, you know, the chief rabbi of Yaakov looks a little bit weird if he is going to claim to be this Orthodox Haredi guy, really, and he's going to now give a hesped, give a eulogy at the most secular, most well-known secular Jew of his time period. So what does he do? Turn the page to page number two. So at the second paragraph from the top, the solution, if you can call it that, Rav Kook arrived at was the following. He would speak at a memorial gathering, but at no time would he pay specific tribute to the deceased Dr. Herzl. Instead, he would speak in generalities. As it turned out, Rav Kook's non-eulogy for Herzl is without doubt one of the most inspired and profound hesbedim ever. What you'll note as we go through it a little bit, and you'll kind of just follow with me over here, is that even though Rav Kook never says the name Herzl, it's very, very clear who he's talking about, and it's probably one of the most profound eulogies that we have to this date given. And in particular, what makes it so special is the level that he holds Herzl on, right? You learn a little bit about Herzl and you hear all these amazing things, but at the end of the day, he was a secular guy, which bodes very, very terribly for a world that was very divided by secular and religious, right? If you remember from your history classes, right, the Zionist movement was primarily secular. Rav Kook was the one who really brought in religion to Zionism and had said how Zionism really is a part of Orthodox Judaism, but Herzl didn't believe in that at all. Very famously, if you want to know, in case you're not familiar, a few historical facts about Herzl, he said at the beginning, he said, the Jewish people don't need the land of Israel, all we need to go is to go to another country where we'll all just be together. The famous Uganda plan that he was a big fan of, that he said, yeah, of course, let's all go to Uganda. What does it make a difference where we go? Obviously, he changed his tune later on in life and believed that, no, Israel was the place to go. But that was who Herzl was. He had no religious bone in his body. And again, this is not a class about Herzl, but that's who the man was. But Rav Kook saw him as such an incredible person, and here's why. Take a look at page number three, right below those three dots in the middle of the page where it says the key. So here is what Rav Kook said at his funeral. The key to understanding this dichotomy lies in examining the individual human being. God created in man a body and a soul, and corresponding to them, forces that strengthen and develop the body, as well as forces that strengthen and cultivate the soul. Ultimate wholeness is achieved when the body is strong and well-developed, and the soul, vital and cultivated, leads all the faculties of the body in the service of the intellect, which is God's will in his world. So on the collective level of Israel, God ordained these two faculties, a faculty corresponding to the physical entity that aspires to material improvements of the nation, and a second facet devoted to the cultivation of spirituality. By virtue of the first aspect, Israel is comparable to all the nations of the world. It is by dint of the second aspect that Israel is unique, as it says, the Lord leads it, Israel alone. Among the nations, Israel shall not be reckoned. It is the Torah and unique sanctity of Israel that distinguishes it from the nations. So without going further, which we will do, what is he trying to say over here? There are two parts of the Jewish people. There's the secular and the religious, and who is he obviously going to then focus on? Right, the secular, to show that even... I'll do a little moonlight here. So we keep going up. That's how he gets the lights back on. So it's clear that he's going to now laud the fact that we do need a secular perspective from the Jewish nation, because we need the material perspective. And so he continues as follows, the last line of the page. Originally, these two faculties were assigned to the two tribes destined, turn the page four, to rule Israel, Ephraim and Judah, which is another way of saying Joseph and Judah. The deeds of the fathers are assigned to the sons. Just as in the beginning of Joseph was the provider sent by God to save many from starvation, who sustained Jacob and his sons materially when they came to Egypt looking for grain, so in future generations the descendants of Joseph would develop the material side of Jewish national existence. Joseph is a paradigmatic in other ways as well. Joseph was swallowed up by the nations. He was also fluent in 70 languages. This last point symbolizes the contiguity between Israel and all the nations of the world. Despite this, Joseph knew the people of his holiness. It is for this reason that Asaph succumbs only to the children of Rachel, meaning Joseph, as the adage goes, the axe handle that fell in the forest is made of wood. Judah, so that's Joseph, right? Joseph is the secular, materialistic paradigm for the Jewish people. Judah, on the other hand, symbolizes that which is distinctive about the Jewish people. Judah became his sanctified one, whereas Joseph, the psalmist says, Shiloh a tent pitched among men, right? Joseph will always be known as the paradigm of secular, materialistic advancement in Jewish history. So he goes on to say that, turn the page to page 5, he goes on to say that originally the Davidic dynasty was supposed to be kind of everything, the dynasty, the kingship that fused all this together. We wouldn't need to have a divided Judaism, we would have a materialistic and a Torah spiritualistic perspective fused under one dynasty, and that would be King David who would bring that all together. Go to the end of line 4 on page 5. Unfortunately, sins brought about that Israel rejected the Davidic dynasty, whereby the nation was divided in two. The 10 tribes subsumed under Ephraim, which is in reality Joseph, and the 2 tribes subsumed under Judah. Were it not for this split, all would have been united under the tree of Judah. Go to page 6, the paragraph that begins with the word even. Even after the separation, the wound might have healed, had the two sides realized that though each has its own propensity, they might benefit one another. Judah could receive from Ephraim ways to round the nation in terms of material and universal. Ephraim could imbibe from Judah the ways of holiness unique to Israel, be they Torah character development or prophetic ability. So what is he saying over here? Something really powerful. Not only just speaking to the fact that King David back in the day, he's speaking to the Jewish people nowadays. If only the secular and the religious people could get together, learn something from one another, then we really would be cooking. But no, we're not doing that. We're not so good. That so we remain split. Turn the page to page number 7 beneath the 3 dots over here. That didn't happen, he says. Right? We never were able to fuse the secular and the religious together. So he writes, so it came about that throughout the exile there is a seesaw effect of these two opposing forces. At times there is exhibited a drive toward material worldly success that flows primarily from the foundation of Joseph and Ephraim. Other times there is a stirring of the spiritual drive for observance of Torah and spiritual development for awe and love of God. Since it is impossible for our nation to attain its lofty destiny other than by actualizing these two components, the universal symbolized by Joseph and the distinctive symbolized by Judah, there arise in the nation proponents of each aspect, those who would enhance spirituality, prepare the way for Mashiach ben David, whose focus is the final destiny. Truly, the focus of life is spiritual attainment, except that the spiritual can only develop properly if it is accompanied by all the material acquisitions of which a full-bodied nation is in need. Those who redress the material general aspects of life prepare the way for Mashiach ben Yosef. So what Rav Kook was saying about Herzl was something very powerful. He essentially, without saying it, called Herzl Mashiach ben Yosef. He was saying that he was the savior of the line of Yosef. Why? Because he was the one who helped bring back the materialistic side of Judaism. He brought us back to the land of Israel. True, he did it in a totally secular, materialistic, only focused on building the land way, and hated Torah, didn't care about Torah at all. But look at what he did. He brought the Jewish people back to the land of Israel in a way that no one before him was really able to accomplish. So he says, he applauds Herzl in a way that only Rav Kook was able to do it by saying that true, he was secular, true, we cannot agree with who he was as a person, but what he did for our nation, there has never been anyone like him in thousands of years. So we have to appreciate and applaud who he was. That's who Rav Kook was, that he was able to say this about Herzl. It was unbelievable, totally revolutionary for the time. And really, it made a huge difference. It sent shockwaves through the community that he was able to applaud him for doing something that no one else, no Haredi religious rabbi, was really able to do in his time. Yeah, Menachem.
How was that received?
So, you can imagine, I did not look thoroughly into it, but as you can imagine, it not so great, right? Some people, you know, the secular Zionist saw this as, wow, this is amazing, right? And the Haredim probably were not such a fan of it. What's really interesting, though, and truly what makes a truly good leader is when everyone probably was a little offended, right? How do you think the real followers of Herzl felt when at Herzl's funeral, this chief rabbi who was asked to speak couldn't even say his name? What's wrong with this guy? Of course, he's had a lot of other amazing things, but nothing truly how they would want it. And the other side, of course, was also probably a little upset. So probably there was a little aggravation between both sides. But there was also, what made Rav Kook so special was the fact that he was able to kind of fight for what he believed in, which was a very spiritual Torah perspective. And the secular world really did appreciate him in a way that was kind of unprecedented. The Haredi world went back and forth with him. He dressed, you know, in the right way. He dressed like a Haredi person. So because of that, he was in many ways appreciated and accepted in that world. He was also a huge Talmud Chacham, so it was hard to kind of fight with him. But it's a good question, and it's really complicated, is the answer. Yes, Stacey.
I was just going to say, the only person that comes to mind that's unifying today would be the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
Right. Mm. And it's fascinating also to note the fact that he does have these some sort of Chabad roots, right? He does have these Lubavitch roots. So it's interesting. Yeah, maybe it's kind of all connected.
This
same teaching, the same Masorah that each of them had, that we have to unite all Jewish people together. Yeah, it's a really good point. Okay, so that was our first major insight into who Rav Kook was, that he gave this hesped, that he gave this eulogy at Herzl's funeral. The next major event that we know, or that we're going to speak about today, rather, I should say, is the famed Heter Mechira scandal. So, turn to page 13, and we'll just give a little bit of background information as you turn to the page. When the Jewish people, in mass, started going back to the land of Israel, it became very problematic, because, of course, we know that why was everyone going to the land of Israel? Well, they were building up Yeshiva, and they were building up an agricultural society. There is nothing more detrimental to an agricultural society than the halachot of Shemitah. Every 7 years, you have to let the land rest. You can't touch it at all. What are you going to do? Your parnasa is the fact that you run a farm. And it could be that magically they would be supported, but for various reasons, that's not seemingly how the world works nowadays. So if they're not going to work their farms for a year, then they are going to lose a lot of money. And these people are totally secular. So what do you do? So back in the 80s, we'll see inside, this had to be dealt with. So there was the famed Heter Mechira. So take a look at source number 13. This preceded Rav Kook, but we'll see how he got involved. So under the words historical background, the polemic began in anticipation of the 1888-89 sabbatical year, yet its antecedents were already evident in 1881 to 1882, the previous sabbatical year, corresponding to the initial stages of the agricultural settlements. The young settlements were unstable at the time, suffering from birth pangs and severe financial difficulties. The concern expressed by the settlers and by the representatives of their patron, Baron Rothschild, was that strict observance of the sabbatical year provisions would lead to the collapse of the settlements and would undermine the entire enterprise. Turn the page, page number 14. Go down about seven lines to the middle of the line, the word "the" suggested. So the suggested solution was to sell the land in a fictitious sale to non-Jews for the duration of the sabbatical year, since the requirement that the land lay fallow applied only to Jewish-owned land in Israel. What does this sound a lot like without reading Torah? Right. Selling chametz, exactly. So read further. The solution was patterned on a model that was utilized in the Middle Ages to circumvent a variety of prohibitions, such as the prohibition of possessing leavened products, chametz, during Passover. So this was not really innovative in the fact that we were trying to circumvent, using that word, in quotes, right, to circumvent Jewish law by selling something over. We have this precedent with chametz. Chametz does not go back. Selling chametz does not go back to Moshe. Moshe did not sell his chametz on Pesach. This is something that's a slightly more modern innovation. When the Jewish people started having more chametz that they could not get rid of because of a huge financial loss, so then Pesach became a huge liability for people, and no one's going to celebrate Pesach if they would have to get rid of hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars of chametz. So the rabbis in the Middle Ages had to come up with something called mechiras chametz, selling your chametz, something that we all do nowadays because we can't even get rid of a loaf of bread. Not a topic for right now, but really that's how it all started, because people were afraid to take a huge loss. Yeah,
Exactly.
There are plenty of areas of There are plenty of areas of Jewish law where we Chazal, our rabbis, the Chachamim of the various times have decided to circumvent the law in a totally, you know, legal and acceptable way in Jewish law, but something that might not have been done before because the times had changed, right? These are some innovations that we take every now and again. Again, part of our traditions, but slightly different from the past. So the thought was, let's do the same exact thing with the land of Israel, right? Why don't we just go ahead and quote-unquote sell the land to someone who's not Jewish just for the year so that we can, in theory, continue to work the land so that we won't lose out all this money. That's what was suggested. So then after that, Take a look at page 15 for a second. So the last few lines five lines from the bottom. The permit was supported by the leading Sephardic rabbis of Jerusalem, and whatever. And Rabbi Yaakov Shaul Eliashar and Rafal Meir Panzel, but encountered strong opposition with the Ashkenazic of the Ashkenazic old settlements in Jerusalem, led by Rabbis Shmuel Salant and Yehoshua Leib Diskin, the Maharil Diskin. Okay, so that's the history of before Rav Kook. This all happened before Rav Kook. Some people were okay with it, some people were not okay with it. Now, fast forward to Rav Kook's time. So Rav Kook got to Yafo in 1904. Now, Shemitah was going to be coming a few years later. Take a look at page 17. This is where, as Jewish people say, the schmaltz hit the fan, right? He says as follows, this piece is as follows, the storm appeared to have subsided and a degree of tacit agreement seemed to have been achieved. Yet in 1909, the polemic reopened with a new vocal and heated debate. The main antagonist at this juncture was the chief rabbi of Tzfat, Rabbi Yaakov David Wolofsky, known as the Ridvaz. Against him stood Rav Kook, the chief rabbi of Jaffa, and the new settlements. Both rabbis had immigrated to the land of Israel in 1904. Thus, 1909 marked the first personal experience of the sabbatical year for each of them. Both took unequivocal positions, and both wrote extensively on the subject. Although the permit had already been in use for several prior sabbatical years, Rabbi Kook found himself in the eye of the storm. His numerous writings in this context included the lengthy introduction to his book, Shabbat Haaretz. He writes this whole book on Shemitah, written in 1909, and the detailed correspondence with his protagonist, the Ridvaz. So, what happens? Turn to page 20. Well, we'll say what happens outside, and then we'll... Sorry?
Take a breath.
Got a little time and we'll have to do it. What happened was that him and the Ridvaz, Rav Kook and the Ridvaz, basically went head-to-head against each other. Before, seemingly they had respect and appreciated each other's Torah knowledge, but once Rav Kook came out accepting the Heter Mechira, saying that Heter Mechira is something that we could rely on to allow the sale of the land of Israel so that Jewish workers could then work, the Ridvaz goes crazy on him and says, this is unacceptable, how dare you do this? We won't go in-depth into the letters. If anyone is interested, I can find copies of the letters. But he is furious at Rav Kook and seemingly just totally wants to put him in chair and put him in excommunication almost for the fact that he was allowing such a terrible loophole in his opinion of Kook. Of course, Rav Kook decided to do this. Let's take a look at page number 20, though, because page number 20 is fascinating. According to this author who wrote this essay that we're reading from is over a 100-page essay. I took some excerpts out of it. You're welcome. And so over here, he explains why it is that he thinks Rav Kook made these innovations and decided to go along for this right to allow Heter Mechira. So take a look at page 20. Take a deep breath. Two fundamental issues shaped Orthodox halachic trends in the modern period. One is the attitude toward changes and innovations in halacha, and the other is the attitude towards Jews who have abrogated observance of Jewish law. I will demonstrate in this article that Rabbi Kook consciously and candidly chose to diverge on these two matters from the accepted approach of Orthodoxy in Western and Central Europe and propose alternative principles for the reality as he saw it in the new settlements in the land of Israel. So I think just for time, I'll just say it outside. Essentially, what he argues is that there are two perspectives where Rav Kook diverged from the Eastern European Jewry perspective. Number one was that he quote-unquote innovated in Jewish law. The Chasam Sofer very famously has the line, Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. It's sort of a pun, if you will, if you're familiar. Sorry?
Nothing new.
Right. Well, the Chasam Sofer said there is nothing, a new innovation is prohibited from the Torah point of view. And what that kind of led to, or what that was in response to, was all the things that were going on in the Jewish world, the Reform Movement and all these other things. We do not innovate. Jewish law is a connection of Masorah from thousands of years, and that is what we follow. Jewish law that has been the same for thousands of years. So the thought of innovating was terrifying to a lot of rabbis at the time. Rav Kook said, no, we have to innovate. We're not going to go away from our Masorah, from our tradition, but what we are going to do is innovate in the confines of our Masorah so that we can live in the 19th, 20th, and then 21st century. That's how we have to function in the world. So that was one major thing that he sort of disagreed with. The other thing that he disagreed with was that back then it was not so common to find very, very religious rabbis interacting so much with the secular Jews. It was kind of, there seemed to be a perspective of the fact that these Jews have given up on Judaism. Terrible, we want them to be religious ideally, but they're not, so what are we going to do? So they'll be in their corner, we'll be in our corner, we'll just do our own thing. Rav Kook said, this is unacceptable. We have to unite the Jewish people. If we are going to move to the land of Israel, if we are going to bring upon the times of Mashiach, then we have to all be together as one single nation. So as a result, he encountered and dealt with Jewish law in a way that would be acceptable not only to Orthodox Jews, but to the secular Jews. Right? The secular Jews would be able to get behind something like this. They don't have to give up their yeshus for a year. They don't have to give up their parnasa for a year. All they have to do is sign some contract that says they're quote-unquote selling this land to some non-Jewish person. Then they get to keep it. They get to keep all the money. So everyone's really happy at the end of the day. So what's the big deal? So therefore, Rav Kook seemed to diverge from these two major points of Eastern European Jewry in order so that he can make the times for Mashiach, for the times of redemption, truly ready so when everyone could be in the land of Israel being able to work together. Yeah, Zeth.
So when we sell the chametz, we can't use it, we can't benefit from it.
Yeah.
If they sell the land under this parnasah, what happened to the proceeds from the sales?
That's a good question. A long answer. Long story short is that everyone kind of was happy with this. Seemingly, they were able to work out something where they wouldn't lose out on everything, but how that works is not so complicated, way beyond the scope of what we're trying to do now. But it's a good question, right? When it comes to chametz on Pesach, we sell it. It's really not ours. If a person, in theory, if you go to your cabinet on Pesach and you take a piece of bread from your pantry that you sold to a non-Jew, you're a thief. Not only are you over on the sort of eating chametz, let's say, but you're also a thief because you stole from someone else. There's also, by the way, not because he got me started on this, Rabbi Riskin very famously on the West Side when he was in Lincoln Square, he used to every single year when he would sell the chametz over Pesach to his non-Jewish friend, whoever he sold it to, he would take that person to one Jewish apartment every single Pesach and go into someone's cabinet and take a piece of bread from the cabinet just to show the fact that this was a real sale. So, again, these are loopholes and innovations in halacha, if you will, but they are ironclad. So how did it work with selling the land of Israel? But we still do this, by the way, nowadays. That's how it works. We still rely on this heter mechira. Again, how that exactly works, does everyone like that? Of course not. How does, in particular, the Haredi community deal with it? It's very, very complicated. But again, not for now. But these are all issues that they had to deal with.
So if there was no heter mechira, what would they use for Shemitah then? What was the other side proposing as a solution to be used?
What do you mean? They would just not touch the land.
Not touch land at all, just leave.
Yeah, they would get their that's what. Yeah.
You wouldn't plant it.
Okay, now moving forward. After Rav Kook supported the Heter Mechira, in 1913, that's when he led his very famed mission to go to all these various yeshivim, the Teshuva campaign that we opened up with, where him and a bunch of rabbis traveled to a bunch of these yeshuvs to kind of help some of the secular people maybe become a little bit more religious, to inspire them a little bit. That's what happened in 1913. 1914, Rav Kook ends up traveling to Europe, and he ends up getting famously stuck in Switzerland and then in London for a number of years because of the outbreak of World War I. So he's stuck there for a few years. So he's in Switzerland for about a year and a half. While he's in Switzerland, that's when he meets someone who would become a very important part of his life and who would be a very important part of continuing the legacy of Rav Kook, a man by the name of Rabbi David Cohen, a.k.a. the Nazir of Jerusalem. You may have heard that before. There was a man who was known as the Nazir of Jerusalem. Without going too deep into it, he became a Nazir. He wanted to kind of find a way to connect to God, so that's how he chose to do it. He never cut his hair, never ate grapes, never drank grapes or things like that. So he really was a Nazir. And this person, that's when he first met Rav Kook, when Rav Kook was stranded in Europe, in Switzerland, in World War, during the time of World War I. So what happened was, the story goes, just because it's so interesting, so the Nazir was learning in the University of Basel at that point, and he had a lot of issues of faith. And he was really struggling with Judaism, and he heard that Rav Kook happened to be in Switzerland at that time, so he said, you know what, I'm going to set up a meeting with Rav Kook. He wrote a letter. Rav Kook said, okay, great, please come meet with me. The Nazir was so excited. He was not, I don't think, the Nazir at this point. But he goes to meet Rav Kook, and the first day that he's with Rav Kook, the Nazir reports that he was totally disappointed, totally miserable. He cannot believe that this was the rabbi that everyone had been speaking about, the famed Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. Why? Because the first day that he was with him and Rav Kook, all they did was discuss Greek philosophy. He says, this is the rabbi that everyone talks about. He's such a Talmud Chacham, such a big Torah scholar. He doesn't know anything. We just learned, we're just speaking about the Greek stuff. And so Rav Kook says to me, why don't you stay the night? And not wanting to, but kind of just deciding to anyways, he begrudgingly decided to stay the night there. And the next day, that's sort of when the Nazir kind of took a turn for the better in his perspective of Rav Kook. He writes as follows in his introduction that he wrote to Orot HaKodesh. You don't have this. I'm just going to read this for you. I have this over here. He says, in the early morning, I heard the sound of steps, then the morning blessings and the prayer of the Akedah in a sublime song and melody. From the eternal heavens on high, remember the love of our ancestors. I listened, and I became a new person. Immediately I wrote, announcing that I had found more than I had hoped for. I had found for myself a Rav. Right? So what happened in the second day, clearly it was a big turnaround from the first day, what happened was that he realized that Rav Kook was able to engage in all of these things that were so non-Jewish, so totally secular. That's how he was able to relate to many people. But obviously, Rav Kook was still Rav Kook. When he would daven, it was like he was on a different planet. When he would learn Torah, he learned Torah better than anyone else. He was able to fuse both of these worlds together. And when the Nazir saw this, he was so amazed and so impressed. And he realized that he was going to be his rabbi for the rest of his life. And of course, the two famous people who ended up continuing the legacy of Rav Kook more than anyone else were his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and the Nazir, Rav David Cohen. So that was a very important moment in his life. 1916, just 2 years later, that's when Rav Kook ends up being back in London. He becomes the rabbi of a shul called Machzike Hadat. And while he was in London, it was a very important time to be there. What happens in early 1900s in England? Good. Balfour Declaration, too bad Jeff isn't here. The Balfour Declaration very famously happened, what year was that passed?
1917.
Good, 1917. So in 1916... Rav Kook decides that he has to play a huge part in trying to push the English government to support the fact that the Jewish people are entitled to their own homeland, right? Obviously, this was a very contentious issue. Take a look at page number... So there are a few pages that are not numbered, but if you go to page 26, the next page will be 27. So go to page 27. So this is an article that sort of describes what happened in the times of the early 1900s when Rav Kook was confronted with trying to push the English government to pass the Balfour Declaration. He writes as follows in this article, the third paragraph from the top, while Rav Kook certainly did not plan to spend 3 years in London, he would later describe the momentous events of this period, events in which he took an active role as a revelation of the hand of God. Soon after his arrival, Rav Kook was forced to battle Jews who were working to undermine the Jewish people's hopes of national rebirth in the land of Israel. Certain assimilated leaders of the British Jewish community who considered themselves Englishmen of the Mosaic faith openly opposed the Zionist front. This powerful group, which included the staunchly anti-Zionist Lord Montague, had great influence on the British government due to their socio-economic and political standing. They publicly declared to the British government that the Jewish religion has no connection to Jewish nationalism and that they opposed all plans to designate Palestine as the Jewish homeland. Not looking too good. In a public notice in response to this national treachery, Rav Kook harshly condemned all those who tear apart the Jewish soul, right, that was a word that he used distinctly, seeking to shatter the wondrous unity of Jewish religion and Jewish nationalism. Turn the page. The second paragraph, he then sent an additional letter urging the members of all British synagogues to immediately request that the British government aid us in our demand to return to our Holy Land as our eternal national home. Rav Kook's efforts succeeded, and the spiteful letter written by the influential Jewish leaders was disregarded. This ultimately led to the passing of the. This is just me speaking now. This ultimately led to the passing of the Balfour Declaration. Take a look at the paragraph that begins under the title of "Congratulating the British Nation." This is something that Rav Kook himself could only do. After the Balfour Declaration was passed in 1917, the Jewish leaders held a large celebratory banquet in London to which they invited lords, dignitaries, and members of parliament. Speech after speech by Jewish communal and Zionist leaders thanked the British for their historic act. When Rav Kook was given the honor of speaking, he announced, and this is something that's unbelievable, "I have come not only to thank the British nation, but even more, to congratulate it for the privilege of making this declaration. The Jewish nation is the scholar among the nations, the people of the book, a nation of prophets, and it is a great honor for any nation to aid it. I bless the British nation for having extended such honorable aid to the people of the Torah, so that they may return to their land and renew their homeland." So it's sort of like a thank you, but like any idiot would have done this, right? Like this was obviously the right thing to say, but only Rav Kook in his powerful and inspiring aura was able to say something like this and I guess not really offend people. But this is what happened, and Rav Kook was very pivotal to the passing of the Balfour Declaration, the fact that it did happen, and even after that, and famously, Rav Kook spoke about these years as a time that it was sort of divinely inspired that he was meant to be here, because if he was not there, who knows if the Balfour Declaration would have been passed. And of course, the Balfour Declaration was probably one of the most important things that happened in the 20th century, the early 20th century, that led to the beginning of the founding of the State of Israel for the Jewish people. So, after this happens, in the year 1919, that's when he returns to the land of Israel as the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Then in 1921, he becomes the chief rabbi of Palestine at that point, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi that we have. Take a look at source number 4, because in source number 4, it's the opening paragraph of Rav Kook from his Sefer Orot, one of the books that Rav Kook himself published in 1921. And of course, what makes this book so special is because it lays out the importance of the land of Israel for the Jewish nation always, but in particular nowadays. And as we started off with, we mentioned how Rav Kook, when he wrote in such a cryptic fashion that really, when you read it in the English, and we'll read the English part, not the Hebrew, it's so difficult to understand. Let's take a look at the English in source number 4 over here in your packet. This is a direct translation to this opening paragraph. Eretz Yisrael is not a peripheral matter, an external acquisition of the nation. It is not merely a means toward the goal of the general coalescing of the nation, nor of strengthening its material existence, nor even its spiritual. Eretz Yisrael is an independent unit, bound with a living attachment with the nation, bound with inner segulot with the nation's existence. As a result, it is impossible to comprehend the essence of the inner segula of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and to reveal the depths of its love through any form of human conceptualization, but only through the Spirit of Hashem, which acts on the nation as a whole. This Ruach Hashem on the nation, the natural spiritual formulation of Israel's soul, sends its rays in natural colors in all paths of sensitivity. It shines its exalted rays in direct accordance with the exalted Ruach HaKodesh, which fills with life and exalted joy the hearts of the holy thinkers and those who are involved in the deep contemplations of Israel. We'll stop right there, and you feel free to read the rest on your own, but you see that that's basically a direct English translation from the Hebrew. I want to say it's gibberish, because I think you get the basic gist of it, but you miss so much of the depth of what Rav Kook was trying to convey in his writings, because when he wrote in Hebrew, he was, like we said before, he was quoting from all over the place. Every single word had its own intense meaning. So again, you could translate it, but one person, you could have 30 different translations of his text that could be vastly different. I have an entire book at home which translates, I think, 6 or 7 of his opening essays in Orot, that's the Sefer, and the book, I think, is about 150 pages long. Just translating and explaining. I apologize, I didn't bring it. If anyone wants to see it, I'm happy to show them.
What's his first language?
Has it been Yiddish?
It's a good question.
I
would think Yiddish. His Hebrew is magnificent. But he also spoke English, right? He was a man who spoke a lot of languages. So, yeah, it's a good question. I apologize for not knowing. I think Yiddish, though, yeah.
I mean, you know, Hebrew is still developing at this point in
the show. Yeah. So... This is one of two writings that I bring of his direct writings. It's so deep and it's so impressive. And if you could understand the Hebrew, I really recommend just taking a look at it. But I do caution you, even if you are someone who can open up a book and read the Hebrew, his writings are so complex. It's difficult. I remember when I was in yeshiva, I had a chavrusa in Orot. It took us like the whole year to get through like three of his paragraphs, because they're just so intense. There's so much depth there. So, but that's how Rav Kook kind of almost started off his being the rabbi, the chief rabbi of Palestine. He recognizing and realizing the fact that this was quintessential for the Jewish nation to have a land of Israel, that it's its own value, that we have to recognize that this is quintessential to the continuity of the Jewish people. He felt very strongly, we do not need the land of Israel to kind of keep us together as a nation. If we wanted that, right, then we could go to Uganda. That's not what Israel is. Israel is its own important value that we have to connect to, that we have to be related to and feel as being important to us. Of course, it has the natural, materialistic advantages of bringing us together as a nation, of us being able to have our own nation, which we can control, but it's so much deeper and so much more than that, and that's what he deals with in a row. Yeah, Zeb.
So, from what you've said, Kook understood the need to reach out to the second Jewish world.
Yeah.
And to work in conjunction with it. What happened to that movement?
What happened with the movement?
I don't have the sense that that's an active, or there's a lot more diverse.
What you're really, that movement is alive and well in Israel, right? The sense of trying to bring secular Jews, secular Israelis back to the fold or to have them appreciate the land of Israel, that's alive and well in my personal opinion. What's not alive and well is
the modernity.
Or I would maybe say it this way, what's not alive and well is the fact that the Haredim and the Chilonim do not get along at all in Israel. We've all read the news, we know exactly what's happening, what's happened there and what continues unfortunately to happen. What seems probable and evident is that even though Rav Kook was at the end of the day a Haredi person in how he dressed and in many ways how he approached the Torah, that did not seem to convey entirely over to the Haredi community as we have it nowadays. And so this divide that we have there, this Haredi-Chiloni divide, that's something that has been brewing since the very beginning, something that Rav Kook tried to counteract, did in many ways counteract, probably helped bring more people to realize how valuable the Chilonim are, and so religious people are able to appreciate them, but the very, very right wing, they still never kind of followed that movement.
I don't think you can really quantify what he attempted to do in 1913 and 2019.
Right.
You just can't. You don't know, you know, people's roots unless you say, my great-grandfather was impacted by Rav Kook. They were off the derech, they were secular Jews,
right.
And now look at who we are today. You know, you can't
right,
come up
right. But you can also say the same thing about, you know, anytime we have a founding father of anything in world history, right? So let's say Rav Kook was not the father of religious Zionism. So what would we have done? The world would have been terrible. Maybe someone else would have come along. You can't view the world like that, right? All you could do is take a look at the historical impact that he had, assume that without him it probably would not have been as good or as advanced, and kind of take that perspective. I don't think you can. Yeah, that's
the other saying. Thing. Also, when you think back, a secular Jew in 1913 in Israel is miles different from a secular Israeli in 2019.
Yes. Yes. Why in particular? It's a good point to bring up. Why in particular?
Well, because in 1913 they were so much, I would think, would be so much more connected to their Judaism, even if they're not practicing.
Those Jews who came in the early Zionistic movements to build the land of Israel, they came to the land of Israel because this was something they believed in. Why did they believe in it? Okay, fine, that's a complicated question. But they believed in being there. Many secular Jews and a whole bunch still want to be there, but many secular Jews in Israel don't even necessarily see the value in being there. I would say the majority certainly does want to be there and values it, but a lot don't. So it's a very different world from back then to now, 100%. Okay, so what happens after this? So in 1924, Rav Kook did something that he had been dreaming of for the longest time. He founded his yeshiva, Merkaz HaRav. How did the name Merkaz HaRav come to be? Well, so kind of colloquially, you understand that Merkaz is the center of HaRav, of Rav Kook. So that's a little bit of a egotistical thing to name a yeshiva after yourself, especially when you have someone like Rav Kook. So his perspective seems to have been, what does it mean, Merkaz HaRav? It means the center, the gathering place of HaRav, of the many, the majority. So Rav Kook named the yeshiva after this to say that this is the yeshiva that is open to everyone. We teach, it's a very complicated bottle of orange juice over there. People have been struggling with it.
I got it. How many more? That's the law degree for
it. When he founded this yeshiva, it was with the intent that he would be able to reach and approach many different people from all over the world. He had an intended curriculum that would be far out there, teaching many different things, not just Gemara, but Tanakh and philosophy and literature and all these various things that he had dreamed of. Not everything ended up being taught exactly how he had dreamed it of. Very famously, he came to the Netziv back in the Yeshiva of Elazar, and he said to the Netziv, why don't you add some things to your curriculum? Things like the Zohar and things, other things would give a more worldly perspective. It seems like that was not necessarily followed, but he had been dreaming of building a yeshiva like this with a very diverse curriculum for many years. A few things that are interesting about the yeshiva in general. The yeshiva was based in a place called Beit HaRav, which was made by someone by the name of Harry Fishel. Anyone know that name? Harry Fishel? Harry Fishel was a huge American philanthropist. He also was the person who donated or helped build the first building in Yeshiva University. So this was a guy who got around a lot, did a lot for the Jewish people. So it certainly is a name worth mentioning. But that's what this yeshiva was going to be, something incredibly innovative and special. A few points on this yeshiva in particular. As we said, many of the perspectives of Rav Kook seem to come out of this idea of the fact that we are going to say that if we have a new Jewish nation living in the land of Israel, well, we have to find new perspectives and ways to confront challenges that we will face. One of those challenges that we'll face is trying to deal with the old Jewish text to make it quote unquote innovative for this time. So heter mechira, right? That whole scandal obviously comes out of a general perspective of making old Torah relevant to this century. And in particular, one of the svarim that he had worked on was something called the Halacha Brura, which was again saying that Gemara is great. We need to learn Gemara, but what happens when you reach the end of the Gemara? You need a conclusion, but you don't have one. So maybe back in Eastern Europe, where you didn't need to know the answer to everything, then fine. But nowadays, you do need to know the answer to everything. If you're going to have your own nation being run by itself by Jews, so you need to have the answer to some of the most complex questions. So he wrote the Halacha Brura, which is a commentary on many Gemaras to kind of reach a practical halachic solution or answer to some of the questions that we had. Although the following is not necessarily relevant for this part of the discussion, I could not leave it out, so I thought I would put it in over here. And that is, among Rav Kook's many fascinating opinions about things, was Rav Kook's perspective on karbanos. So this is probably one of the most, for those who are familiar even remotely, this is probably one of the most heavily debated, most confused opinion of Rav Kook. So take a look at source number 5. It comes after right after source number 4. Sorry, the page number isn't on here. So there are a few things that I want to point out. So go to not the first page of source number 5, the second page of source number 5. So this article goes into a lot of depth to sort of build up this question of if there will be karbanos in the Third Temple. People believe that Rav Kook thought that there will not be karbanos in the Third Temple. So this author, probably rightfully so, seems to portray Rav Kook as not believing that. But take a look the towards the end of the second paragraph over here, where in the middle of the line it says, fast forward to the first chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who some claim believe that animal offerings will not be reinstituted when the Third Temple is rebuilt. It is based on his commentary on the Siddur, on the sentence at the end of Shmoneh Esrei, Va'arva la'Hashem minchas Yehuda v'Yerushalayim k'mei olam v'chasanim k'admoni yos. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant to Hashem as in the days of old and as in the ancient years. Rav Kook wrote as a commentary on this, in the future, the abundance of knowledge will spread to and penetrate even animals, and the sacrifices, which will then be from grain, will be as pleasing to God as in days of old. What does it sound like he's saying?
No
karbanos, right? Well, we still have the mincha offering and things like that. Sure, well, grains, yeah, of course we'll do that. Animals, of course not. Keep going. This would limit the Third Temple to only vegetarian karbanos. However, this does not seem to be the end of the story, because Rav Kook writes in Igrot HaRi'iyah, and regarding sacrifices, it is more correct to believe that everything will return to its place and God willing be fulfilled when the redemption comes and prophecy and the divine spirit return to Israel. So you have these two very conflicting pieces of Rav Kook. One that seems to say there will not be karbanos, the other that seems to say that there will be karbanos. A peripheral note to mention about this, because of the fact that so much of Rav Kook's writings were not published while he was still alive, a lot of people do question the legitimacy of some of his writings. So there are things that are attributed to him that some people say maybe it was not written by him. Nonetheless, you can't function like that, right? If you have writings from him, I think you either have to assume it's all or nothing in many ways and leave the rest to sort of the scholars. Were you have a question? So taking at face value that both of these writings, both of these opinions were his, so how do you kind of stem the two of them? How do you make sense of it? So this suggests strongly that Rav Kook did believe that animal offerings will indeed be part of the Third Temple, and that people will have a better understanding and appreciation for animal offerings. His statement on this verse refers to a far-off time past the Chias HaMesim, when animals will have some level of human intelligence in an idyllic world where only vegetarian offerings will be brought. So says this author over here, that how do we understand Rav Kook's writings? Well, they're both talking about different time periods. When Mashiach comes now, God willing soon, we'll have karbanos, it'll be business as usual, exactly what we expected it to be. Again, this is not a shir talking about how we ourselves deal with karbanos in the 21st century, but assuming and believing that this is our core belief, that karbanos will return, Rav Kook was a proponent and believed that as well. Seemingly, though, if you do say that Rav Kook did say the former, that there will be this outpouring of knowledge, it seems to be that that's going to be talking about some way, way far out time, once we've already all come back to the land of Israel, once we rebuilt the temple, once we've already been doing sacrifices for a while, maybe at some point we will then also have a world without karbanos itself, themselves. But for the time being, the general perspective is that Rav Kook seems to have believed in them, and only believe maybe sometime in the way, way out future that we would not have them. Okay. There are a few more final things that we do have to discuss before we sort of get to the end of his life. One in particular is, and I think we'll just do some of it outside, but again, feel free to take a look inside. So in 1925, the year after he founded his yeshiva, it was the inauguration of Hebrew University. That's when he spoke at its opening ceremony. And at this opening ceremony, it was actually very interesting because, again, putting it into the context of everything happening then, there were the secular people, and there were the religious people. There were the religious people who valued yeshivot in the classical sense of learning Torah. Merkaz Harav was an innovation and sort of a stirring of the pots of what a regular yeshiva was. But now you have a college opening up in the land of Israel. How more of a contradiction could you have for a secular university to open up in the Holy Land of Israel? So that was very complicated, but obviously Rav Kook, in his very special way, did speak at the inauguration of Hebrew University. We'll see it outside, but it is source number 6 on the inside. It's a transcript of what he did speak about. Everyone's turning there anyway, so let's take a look really briefly on page 32.
Did you mention its name?
Sorry?
Did
you mention its name? he does mention its name. Okay, so take a look at the top of source number 6 on 32. The prophet of consolation prophesied, "Lift up your eyes and look about. They have all gathered and come to you. Your sons shall be brought from afar, your daughters like babes on shoulders. As you behold, you will glow. Your hearts will fear and rejoice, for the wealth of the sea shall pass on to you. The riches of the nation shall come to you." Today is great event, he says. The opening of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem on Mount Scopus is such glorious ceremony and splendorous festivity amidst a gathering of tens of thousands of our sons and daughters from all parts of the land of Israel and from all the lands in the diaspora is, on a reduced scale, the living fulfillment of the holy vision of this prophecy. True, not all have gathered together in the beginning of the ingathering of the exiles is on a small scale, yet this very ingathering is a sure sign that the set time has come and that the gates of redemption are opening before us. Our hopes are strengthened that the great day is near when all the exiles will gather together and join us, the redeemed ones, joyously going up to Zion. So what he says over here is very clearly is that even though Hebrew University, and he goes and kind of spells this out even further, but we won't do it inside, but feel free to take a look. He says that Hebrew University, it's part of the fulfillment of recognizing that us to be an autonomous nation in the land of Israel, that we also will have this college over here. And this college is a part and parcel of that greater, grander vision, and that's why this is so special, and he says how amazing it is. He does kind of take a step back and does say at the end of the day that, of course, as amazing as this university is, learning the Torah is really where it all comes down to. You have to learn Torah, you can't just have secular studies, but the fact that he spoke there, the fact that he embraced this opening was obviously very special, something that at this point I hope we have come to expect from him after hearing about the rest of his biography. But that's who he was there, that he was able to speak here and say how special this was, even though certainly according to many, maybe more to the right people, would not have been so okay with this. Finally, after this, Rav Kook lived out for a few more years, for 10 more years to be exact, and he was known to the very end as someone who was incredibly special, one of the most influential chief rabbis, the first chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the land of Israel. In 1935, that's when he did pass away on the 3rd of Elul in the year 5695 in the Hebrew date, two weeks before his 70th birthday. I think just for time, we won't read it inside, but there were a number of eulogies that were given that kind of really in many ways encapsulated who he was. But what's so special obviously is that when you have a great person who passes away, you have a number of great people who eulogize that person, and each of them speak about a different great aspect that they themselves encountered. But one thing that everyone seems to agree on is the fact that he had this great and unending and incredible love for every single Jew. And I think that's really how to truly encapsulate who Rav Kook was, the fact that he was the founder of religious Zionism, that he really was someone who always pushed for and showed how special the land of Israel was for everyone nowadays. But that he was so much more than that he also wanted, he saw as part of that vision to unify all Jews, to bring everyone together, to truly bring about the redemption. And take a look at source number 8 very quickly, as some of you have already seen. That is his matseva, his tombstone. And there are 3 dates on this tombstone. Can anyone make out what the dates are? Or what they're attribute, what the dates are of? I'll tell you the actual dates are the 28th of Iyar 5664, the 3rd of Elul 5669, and the 3rd of Elul 5695. So the final one, that's obviously the date that he passed away. What are the first 2 dates? No. Good. Okay, right, and they are written right there. Alright, so okay, Allah le'eretz ha-kodesh, chav cher Iyar. Okay, the first date is the fact that he came to the land of Israel. That was in the year 5664. We know when he came to Yafo. The next was Ala Yerushalayim, when he came to Yerushalayim. That was the third of Elul Tafresh Ayin Tet, and finally the day Allah HaShamayma, when he went up to the heavens, when he went up, when he passed away. That was the third of Elul 5695. Those are the three dates that encapsulated of Cook's life, his value in appreciating the land of Israel. He kept going higher and higher. He went from Europe to the land of Israel, going up one step higher to Jerusalem, to one step higher, going up to the heavens, to passing away. Source number 9, in my opinion, really encapsulates who he was. And as we said, that he was the great unifier, the one who believed that everyone had to be together all the time. It's part of his Sefer Ein Ayah, which is written on a few Masechtos. This one in particular is written on Masechtos Brachos, on various agadic parts. And he says as follows, I'll just read the Hebrew, feel free to follow along, but I will translate. Yesh Toim. Shechoshvim shehashalom ha'olamei lo yibaneh ki ela al yedei tzivyon echad b'deos v'tichunot. The only way, says Rav Kook, that many people believe that you can have peace in this world is if everyone agrees to the same thing. Im kin kesherom tam echacham chokrim b'chachma v'al yedei ha-mechkar mitrabim ha-stadim v'ha-shitot choshvim shebazeh him gormim l'machlokas v'hefech ha-shalom. When people are engaged in other opinions and other things that don't necessarily relate to their own, they think, ach, you're bringing apart peace in the world, you're tearing it all apart. U'be'emet, in truth, he says, eino kin ki ha-shalom ha-amiti, the true peace in the world, i'ashar she'yavo la'olam. The only way that you can have true peace is by recognizing that there are lots of opinions to bring into peace. You have to bring in all opinions in the world to achieve true peace. To show how every single person has their own in particular special value, their own special opinion to bring to the world, and to fuse all of them together to say that everyone has a place at the table, that everyone is valuable and important. That's how you achieve true peace in the world. And that was who Rav Kook was, trying to bring peace, trying to bring about the redemption every single day of his life by bringing people to the land of Israel, by recognizing that there could be a connection between the secular and the holy, ultimately hoping that that the land of Israel would come to be and that Mashiach would come. We've seen what I would argue is one of the first parts of his dream, the realization of the fact that the state of Israel became an actual state in the 48th, and of course Yerushalayim was back in our hands. And then, God willing, we will all merit to see what was Rav Kook's true dream, and that was the redemption by bringing Mashiach and the building of the Beis HaMikdash. That would be, in Rav Kook's true eyes, the way to really fulfill about his legacy. But the truth is, we can even start before that. If you really want to follow in the ways of Rav Kook, all you have to do is focus on uniting the Jewish people, befriending all those around you, those who are like you, those who are not like you. If you can do that, then in that way you will truly have learned from the great master and the great rabbi that Rav Kook was.